Hello and welcome to Promise. I'm your host, Sean. Here, we explore the promise of new technologies from synthetic biology to superconductors, and how science fiction is turning into science fact. Every episode, we cover new ground and pose the question, what is the world that we want to build? If you dream of shaping the future, you've come to the right place. In this episode, Ben and I explore a plethora of groundbreaking topics that blur the lines between the fantastical and the tangible. From the advanced manipulation of light that brings us one step closer to real-life lightsabers, to controversy of totally not eugenics that could redefine what we understand about genetic selection and the future of human evolution. We also cover potential ways swarming nanobots could help us rethink what infrastructure means, how it works, and so much more. Please, enjoy. All right, welcome back, everybody, to the Promise Podcast. Back, as usual, with me is Ben, the science communicator extraordinaire. Ben, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. Very excited.
Me too. We have a really interesting choice of articles spread between us today, as we were talking about offline. Some really handy video game comparisons. If anybody out there is a gaming nerd, then perhaps we might have something to talk about. So I've got three articles today. You've got four, and we actually overlap on one of them for the first time. I think I might let you handle that shared article, and I might chip in with any additional thoughts if I see them, just because you are much better at explaining this emerging scientific physics technology than I am.
That sounds good to me.
Cool. All right. The first thing that I found this week, an article about nanorobots and how scientists have figured out how to basically engineer social interactions between them. They use light to create what they've called adaptive time delay, which allows each nanobot to adapt to motion and changes around them. So if you think about how a school of fish moves through the water, they don't all move in the same direction. They flow in a wave. Same with flocks of birds in the sky. So this effectively allows these nanobots to move in the same manner as opposed to along a predefined route or moving in the exact same direction at the same time. A couple of implications here, obviously, to control drone fleets in the same way or autonomous navigation for trucks and cars in the same way, makes these nanobots more responsive and more, I guess, robust to complex environments and how they might change and adapt on the fly. So if you think about what this could do, man, think drug delivery in specific areas in a bloodstream, for example, or a swarm of robots collectively cleaning contaminated water, things like that. So that's article number one. Number two broke my mind a little bit because, admittedly, I only have a middle school understanding of physics. But basically, scientists have figured out a way to make light curve with the aim of improving wireless communication. So if you think about how Wi-Fi works today or your cell phone signal works today, basically it's broadcast from wherever the tower is or your router is at home, fills the space with waves and bounces around the walls and eventually gets to your device. Now, part of the problem with that is this method of transmitting data is reaching its limit, where with the amount of data that we consume nowadays, we can't really use this method to a great level of effect for much longer. So what they've done is upped the communication frequency to terahertz levels. Currently, we're in the gigahertz range, and they can make the terahertz signal follow a curved trajectory instead of being blocked by things like walls or bodies even. So if you think about the jump from 4G to 5G, 5G enabled much better download speeds, but they were a much shorter range, and you really had to be in the line of sight of a 5G tower for it to really have significant effect. If you went around the corner, around the wall, the signal just died. But with these terahertz signals, we could effectively bend that signal around the corner. And I don't really understand how it works, but they've tested it. And Ben, maybe you can provide a better summary than I can, as you did offline. But yeah, those are my first two. The last one is about levitating material discovered by some Japanese scientists, which I'll throw over to you, Ben, to explain.
Thank you. I'm really interested in that herd of the little nanobots and the concept of swarming, not from the perspective of how we can use the swarm, but I wonder how much understanding we can gain of turbulence from swarming robots and having real-life practical applications of thousands of little communicating objects. I wonder how many discoveries will happen around turbulence just with how unpredictable and how much turbulent calculations rely on super high-powered simulations or practical tests in water chambers and wind chambers. I would be very interested to see whether or not there's work that can be done there merging those two ideas. Yes, sorry, the levitating. Levitating material is a very interesting piece that came out this week, looking at levitating an object without any external power. So there was a team at Japan's Okinawa Institute of Science and Tech, and they demonstrated a levitating material on a block of magnets without any external sources of power. The way that this works is what's called eddy currents, if anybody's heard of those. Eddy currents are essentially magnetic forces that start to come up when objects in a magnetic field try and move. A lot of the time, they don't fully stop an object, but they'll instead slow it down. So if you've ever had a copper pipe, you know that copper is not magnetic. You drop a little magnet down, it should come out immediately. But in fact, it actually slows down quite a bit while it rotates through that copper pipe. And that's because as it goes, it starts inducing some eddy currents and the magnetic field controls how fast it falls or moves. And so what they've been able to do is create a system where an object that's falling is producing enough magnetic field in the eddy currents to actually keep it in position. They've done this at room temperature. So it's not a case of superconducting, but rather a case of using the normal magnetic processes that occur, but in a very specific and finely tuned way to basically lock an object in a levitative state without needing to pump anything into it. It's super interesting. The possibilities at the moment only inside this system, it has to be very specific, but very interesting to see where it goes.
Can I just chime in with a question there? Just based off your description of eddy currents, would a suitable comparison be like a satellite staying in orbit? Since it's effectively constantly falling just on a specific path.
It almost is. So orbiting, I don't know if you've ever heard of it described like this. It's like unsuccessfully falling over and over.
Yep.
You've tried to fall, but you're going so fast that you just never quite make it to the ground. And you're falling over and over. Another way I would say to think about it is if you've got your hand in a pool in the water and you try and move your hand through the water, you feel the resistance of your hand, the currents your hand makes as it falls. And what's happening is as your hand, as this piece of material is falling through a magnetic field, which is the water, it's creating this turbulence and pressure underneath it, which in a pool, the pressure is made of water. In a magnetic system, the pressure is made of a magnetic field. So as the item is falling, it's creating a cushion basically underneath it. And any physicist who are listening will know that is technically incorrect. But I think we can all agree that when you're talking about systems this complex, you've got to be a little bit wrong to explain how it all works. But essentially, you're creating a cushion of magnetic energy underneath it for this system. I don't believe it lasts forever, but they've been able to drag that process out quite a long time.
Yeah, right.
My second article is about polaritons. A little bit of quantum talk. When we're using quantum systems, we can build them using light photons in order to create this complex arrangement which produces a quantum computer or whatever quantum system we're studying. There's a lot of things that go on involved with this. I'm not going to dive super far into it. But something that is used when we're talking about photons and quantum systems is polaritons. Polaritons are essentially a special bundle of particles between photons that travel at the speed of light, have no mass, and we bundle them with something that is heavy, which is a boson. And so that gives light a mass, sometimes called hard light, but today we'll talk about polaritons. Scientists at the Department of Physics at the Pohang University have created a new technique for manipulating polaritons and creating polaritons at room temperature. So there's a lot of things that these things could be used for, but really what's interesting is that never before have we been able to manipulate them so easily and with a system that's not needing superconducting or supercooling to 10 degrees Kelvin, so cold. Instead, they can do it inside of a lab. So very interesting and fantastic breakthrough to see the complex systems and work that can be done based off this breakthrough. I've got one more science and tech one, one more physics-related one, which came out of the University of Buffalo this week, a new paper investigating magnetic properties of materials. And they're talking about what we call quantum paths and electrons moving along those paths. To break it down, essentially, we couldn't accurately predict certain magnetic and electrical properties of materials. We had a few ways of doing this. Sometimes we could get close. Sometimes we'd be off by a factor of 10,000. And it wasn't until we experimentally verified things that we'd find out more accurate results. But with this breakthrough, we're able to improve that predictive behavior, meaning that we can start theoretically studying materials and start finding suitable candidates for materials without needing to experimentally validate each one over and over. It's very interesting, opens up a brand new avenue for material science and understanding what materials will be suitable for our technology in the future, rather than sticking to what we know or what we can validate physically. Very interesting. My last one, to move far away from physics and material science, is looking at a company called Orchid. The founder of Orchid had an interview this week talking about using their capabilities on herself. And Orchid is a gene screening company. So they screen the full genetic spectrum on embryos and are able to determine what genes are or are not present inside of an embryo. So you can take your embryos for IVF, you can get them completely screened using Orchid, and then you can choose what embryos to use or discard. This is, I'm sure many people will make comparisons to movies or TV shows that have similar themes. Similar themes have been done in the past in reality. We're really talking about, and they refer to it as a naughty word, but it's some form of eugenics at some point. It's an interesting moral dilemma, whether or not it's good or bad, but the tech behind it itself is still interesting to see how far we've come from taking 6 months to fully screen a human, the first time we ever sequenced a human genome, to being able to do a dozen or two dozen embryos at once and are able to spit that information back to the parent for their choice. It's an interesting journey, and now that we've landed in what's essentially Gattaca, I feel like we're at a bit of a tipping point for that direction. But yeah, so from a tech and science perspective, amazing that a startup can just begin doing this.
Yeah. My first question, actually, is this legit, or is this like Theranos, think about all the things we could do with a drop of blood while over-promising and under-delivering?
It's, I think, depending on what you're looking for, you can get as much out of this as what you're looking for. If you want to make sure that your embryo has red hair and green eyes and has really long limbs and is tall and will be a certain height, I'm sure that there are methods to make sure that you've got the genes from both parents to have that embryo have what you want, and you can keep screening embryos until you get it. If all you're looking for is, I just want to make sure my child doesn't have the gene that me and my partner are both carriers for, then that's all you need to know, and you can get it done through Orchid. Right. I think there's an avenue for designer babies, definitely. But I think a lot of parents are just more worried than anything else. And this is a great system to be able to say, we've fully screened the embryo. You do or do not have this list of things. And it allows parents to make a more informed decision. I think there are a much bigger moral conversation about that. Not something that we need to touch. But just from a science perspective, I think you get out as much as you want to from a process like this.
Yeah, okay. All right, so I'm going to put my first thoughts down on the table here based off of everything that we've covered today. And if anybody has played games in the last, I guess it's probably a bit over a decade now, you probably would have come across a series of games called Mass Effect. I have mentioned it once before on the podcast. All of the articles we've covered today, including the Designer Babies article, have some sort of tie to that game, which is also a high praise for the writing of the story of that game. The story itself is fairly complex, but it's science fiction. It's set about 150 years in the future from where we are now, and humanity is exploring the stars, getting in touch with other species, trying to figure out what it means to be part of galactic society, navigating a whole bunch of new technologies, and trying to figure out what it means to also control other societies, including ones which have developed out of swarm robots as well. Yeah, I think a lot of things that I can tie back to that. It's interesting to see that we are heading down a path to a future like that, at least in terms of having the technology available.
I've played Mass Effect. I love those games. I absolutely
You're playing it now again.
I am. I'm playing it now. I'm replaying it. It's very interesting to see, especially in a modern era, how even on a timescale of a decade or a decade and a half, how science fiction and real life science can start to come together, or that those lines are not in fact parallel, but slowly converging. I think it's interesting if you look back 50, 60 years, you look at, or actually even further, you look at sci-fi novels from the first half of the 20th century to the tech we have now. And I wonder if there's an interesting philosophical talk as to whether the musings of an author or a writer who makes some sort of mark on society with their writing and ideas, and how that influences the tech we end up with, or whether or not it's almost like a prescience of just understanding where we're going. Whether it's a chicken or the egg, did they create crazy ideas that where we went, oh, actually, that's, we could do that? Or are they seeing the patterns happening and estimating where we're going to end up? Especially with, you just look at things like data pads in science fiction, novels and TV shows, and now everybody has iPads in the early 21st century. And the idea of visually replacing environments with a holodeck, but now we could do that in virtual reality quite easily. And those sort of, are we converging? Is it, are we being informed? Are we still leading? And how hard is it going to be for us to avoid all of the pitfalls that those sci-fi novels and movies and TV shows and games ultimately present to the reader and the audience of, this was great, except they forgot to do this, or they thought they were right, and they thought they had the moral high ground, but they didn't think about this. I think that interesting, maybe a bit of a warning from those authors that we might need to heed.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And look, it's part of what we're trying to do here on this iteration of the Promise podcast is to present the emerging technology, hopefully in a way that is accessible and engaging, and to plot out what that future could look like. And obviously the utopia dystopia cases that we churn through are avenues for people to look at these ideas in a way to think about what is the future that they want to build and do with that whatever they wish. But hopefully we put forward a compelling case that we'd much rather one future than the other.
I hope so.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so if we get into a little bit more detail about why I think this sort of pans out like Mass Effect. So if we have these engineered robots who have some basic level of social interaction, you're starting to have the physical component for artificial intelligence to navigate space. And you combine both of those things together with a couple generations forward of spatial computing. And it's not too far of a leap in imagination to go, okay, it's a swarm of coordinated robots are just doing their thing, thinking their own way, mm-hmm. in a way that we as humans probably won't ever understand because they've achieved that consensus on their own. That's the first thing. With bending light, that's the faster than light travel that they speak about and is a general premise across a lot of science fiction that takes place on multiple planets, even the recent release of Dune, for example, and the concept of folding space using spice. With the hard light that you mentioned, polaritons, first couple of things that came to mind, one is shields, again, visible in Dune, part of plenty of video game universes as well, or things like a lightsaber in Star Wars, or the Omni-tool in Mass Effect, which appears as and when necessary, is a physical thing that you can touch, and then disappears again. And then, oh man, the eugenics, the dirty word, again, also part of the video game universe, and part of Dune, actually, as well. Being able to select who lives and dies in order to find the perfect being or to control what might be considered unruly, all coming to coalesce to reality. And the theoretical physics breakthrough obviously underpins a lot of this because there's a lot of stuff that we can theorize or we can predict about what the future might look like, but we can't do it based off of what we know of current material science. Like, how would you actually make a personal portable hard light shield that everybody can have on their own body? Perhaps this might be the breakthrough in physics that we need. Yeah, those are my thoughts. I can obviously dive into why each of those can be part of a utopia world or a dystopia world. Do you have anything else to add, or should we jump into that segment of the show?
I think I love all of the comparisons that we've made. It's interesting to see how none of these scientists would pretend, or even if they were thinking it, would acknowledge these are almost like baby steps towards, oh yes, we're definitely, this is step one for a lightsaber. But I think every scientist and everyone who's a bit of a nerd or enjoyed that sort of pop culture is going to look at these and go, how long until I get my lightsaber? How long until I get my personal shield? How long until I can get warp jump up? If we can bend light, we can bend space. If we can bend space, how long till I can warp jump to Mars?
Yep.
Warp jump to Sagittarius B. I think it's very fun to start to see the babiest of baby steps in those directions.
I forgot about the levitation one. Hoverboards. Oh, yes. Back to the Future.
Absolutely. That's a classic.
Yeah. And the hype that we're getting to the year and it hasn't happened yet. And then the year came and went and it still hasn't happened. But it might now.
Yeah, that personally, hoverboards feel like the worst addition to our roads when we've already got scooters. But it would be fun.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
So much fun.
All right. Shall we jump into dystopia first? And we can end on a high note.
Let's do dystopia first.
Yeah. Okay, thoughts on dystopia. Probably the clearest things that point to a dystopia or have a clear path to a dystopia are, to my mind, the swarming robots and the eugenics startup.
Mm-hmm.
I know she doesn't want to call it that, but look, it is.
Do we need a little eugenics counter at the end of the episode? Just a little ding every time we say it?
It's like a swear jar.
Yeah.
Look, it effectively is, and like we were discussing offline, there's a complicated moral question here about, sure, it's gene screening and selection of specific properties that we want or don't want in children. And I raised the point that, well, we've done it in a much more crude way with things like eliminating diseases which would have affected us in the past, or genetic modification or selective breeding for the food that we eat that enabled us to rapidly expand our population over the 20th century. In a way, we've done it at a force crude level, and this is much more targeted. Where the line gets drawn is TBD. But in any case, dystopia case, like we said, there's millions, trillions, billions of lives that could start and then be discarded just because they don't have the quote-unquote right features. And it's potential that we will never know philosophically. But at the same time, this is also the same argument that gets used by anti-abortion advocates and the removal of choice from a woman who seeks to do that. With robots, I'd say it opens up the path to Skynet, basically. And Skynet, and also, what was that other movie with Will Smith? I, Robot?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, which was just like a coordinated swarm of humanoid robots rebelling against their masters at some point and totally kicking our ass when it came to the fight scene. And I think we're already on a path that is a little bit of a slippery slope towards those outcomes for both the gene screening and the robot swarming. Obviously, there's a lot of water that needs to go under the bridge before we get to those outcomes, but the dystopia case is we do get there. We do get to a point where we have no control over a swarm of robots. We don't understand how they think, what they're trying to do, and they could supersede us, which some might say is not necessarily a bad thing, but I would like to still be around and for us to still be around. Yeah.
I would like to add to your dystopia. We're talking about spatial computing and a bunch of robots moving through physical space, but controlled digitally, offline, AI, whatever it is that controls them. I wonder, in a world where not only does everybody have their phone, but in a world where Apple has AR headsets that are mapping inside houses, outside spaces all of the time, just how much data is being collected on your physical space and the physical spaces you go to that you don't realize is being captured, and how that data can be used by these systems to already know people's behaviors and how big spaces are and where they need to be, and using that in conjunction with the ability to move through that physical space. Again, a loss of control would be a nightmare scenario, just having things moving around without any of our input or feedback or control, and completely unpredictable. I wonder how, just to, not that it's it might be dystopian, but I wonder how much of whether or not something is good or bad is determined by whether or not it is in our control.
Totally.
I would guess that swarming robots that we can't control could be super useful for us. They could add to the benefit of our lives, but in a dystopia, it's where we are being surveilled and data is being captured, and we're being exploited through the use of something that knows where everybody is and can find everybody, almost like a big brother, like having a spider cam from the tennis. I think there's a question there of the control of how things move in a 3D space and the automatous nature of swarming bots or having something that's digital move through a physical space, and whether or not that's a negative or a positive thing. I think there are, but definitely in his dystopia case, it's a loss of control for us. Things are moving without our input, without our feedback, without us being able to determine whether it's a good or a bad thing, a boon, or have a significant negative impact. And the worry that comes along with that, the uncertainty that comes along with that. But also, in a world where Apple has the Vision Pro goggles and is constantly mapping 3D spaces, that information is also available. And so you're talking about potential surveillance and moving through your space and influencing the environment around you for a purpose that isn't defined by you. And I think definitely a dystopia from our perspective, leaning into Orchid and the eugenics. We'll get to the positive, but I think it's easy to see when you talk about movies like Gattaca and sci-fi movies where we're talking about genetic screening or genetic engineering. There's a rabbit hole that you can easily go down, picking specific traits, throwing certain traits away, breeding certain traits in, breeding certain traits out. And the control over that could mean, I'll lean heavily into Gattaca and say, oh, everybody gets genetic screened, you go for a job, they know for a fact you've got the ADHD gene. This is a job that needs you to act a certain way, to think a certain way, and they've determined that individuals with ADHD are not suited. It doesn't actually take into consideration the human beings or their personality or how they act or how they live their lives. All that's determined is that you have a genetic factor, and that matters more than anything else. And I would say that is, for me, the dystopia where we leave the humanity aspect behind and it becomes all about the genetic component of an individual.
So what you're saying there is we effectively have two ends of the spectrum. One is where we have an extreme loss of control, and the other is we have a hyper level of control. And both of those sort of strip away what it might mean to live a human life, basically. Emphasis on human and humanity in it. But I just had this funny thought. Maybe not funny if you're experiencing it, but with your robot swarming dystopia, let's say someone goes, hey, Alexa, turn on the lights or something like that. And Alexa responds, no, and directs your Roomba and your Dyson to corner you so that, I don't know, the rest of your IoT devices can wreak havoc on your home.
Where it's you've turned on the light in the middle of the night and Alexa goes, no, that will disturb the neighbors.
Yeah.
I'm gonna keep those lights off.
Yeah. It's like Night at the Museum, but with all of your devices instead of displays. Or hey, at that stage it might even be your displays.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, should we do Utopia Case?
Yes, I think that's a good place to end. Is on a happy note. Yeah.
Cool. Should I go first or do you want to go first?
I'm happy to go first if you want me to.
Yeah, go for it.
Cool. We've talked about baby steps. We've talked about leaning into these sci-fi stories that we know and we love and seeing the potential, not for us, but for the generations forward, just seeing all of that. And I think for me, a utopia is where we don't lean away from things like this being baby steps. And we understand that these are, the levitating material is a super fun experiment to do. And it's a very interesting use case for the manipulation of eddy currents and creating an example of material science that we haven't done before. Maybe it's not useful for us right now, but not shying away from the research and taking the time to say, this is something that will be useful or could lead to something useful in 100 years. We won't see the benefit of it now, and not shying away from any of that. The practical aspects of what we've talked about, like the eugenics, this one, although there's eugenics is the naughty word and we don't want to, there's lots of negative connotation around it. The screening process itself means that families can feel more confident and know that they're having a baby that doesn't have health issues that would otherwise be a significant concern for them. Whether that's things like being predispositioned to certain cancers by having a certain gene, or not having a congenital disease that you and your partner are both carriers for and you don't want your child to have. Knowing that there could be complications being able to have that peace of mind and having the choice really is what's, I think, the most important part. And that, to me, is a utopia where we're not using the choice to create designer babies where we want a certain height, weight, hair color, eye color, certain amounts of muscle or ability to make muscle tone. But instead, we focus on the health and well-being of the kids. And it's a tool to do that. We have medicine that helps people with their ailments, why can't we treat this as a way to prevent ailments and to make sure that those aren't happening? To me, that's a utopia where we're thinking about the next generation and not using things like this just for our own aesthetic gain or material gain.
Yeah, I get it. Okay, I agree with you in regards to the genetic screening and it being used for health purposes. And I know I referenced that we've done this kind of stuff before at a really crude level, and it has been for health purposes.
Mm-hmm.
If we can maintain that, great. I don't see a huge problem for it, so long as it's something that is accessible rather than gated. With things like all of the development in material sciences and robotics, I'd say the first thing that comes to mind with a swarm of robots is just flexibility in our infrastructure. So if we think about something like, let's say the way that we generate energy right now, right? If we take things like solar farms or wind farms, they're bolted into place and they're just left there to generate energy as and when needed, or keep generating energy provided the conditions are right.
Yeah.
But with the ability to keep this kind of infrastructure on the move, or even to, let's say they were to generate energy from waves, wave energy,
mm-hmm.
the fluid dynamics associated with that would make a lot more sense for a fluid set of infrastructure to take advantage of, just theoretically. Obviously, practicalities remains to be seen.
Mm.
Things like all of the fixed hardware that we currently have, which creates a lot of limitations on how and where we can develop our society, having the flexibility to swarm and keep things fluid opens up a lot of avenues in ways that I think we haven't thought about before. One thing that I'm reminded of is, I can't remember where I read about this. I believe it was in the book Eating to Extinction, which I highly recommend to everybody, by the way, where the author talks about how as we developed the ability to produce energy, that enabled us to move our settlements and production away from natural sources of energy. So
mm-hmm.
instead of having our industry by a riverside because the mill had to be powered by water, it could now be somewhere else outside of town because the mill could now be powered by fossil fuels. And hence why we have things like huge transmission lines that cut through the countryside. So if you think about that shift in the way that we build our cities, I think we can have a similar kind of thing for more fluid infrastructure. That would open up utopias and dystopias in and of itself, but I'd say a dramatic rethinking about how we live would be a utopia there.
I love that.
Cool. Yeah, your thoughts. Love to hear them.
One last thought. You can cut this if you'd like, but I think in the direction that humankind is going, in the direction that this planet's going, I think eventually we'll solve or at least adapt to changing climate, whatever that means. I think there's solutions on the table, but maybe we won't get out of this unharmed in terms of an ecological perspective. I could see, and ideally we wouldn't, but a potential solution to the loss of bees and insects and pollination could be swarming micro robots. And that's an interesting middle ground going, we probably won't fully fix it, but in case we don't,
here's one I prepared earlier.
Yeah, not to prepare for the worst, but in case it happens, interesting to see that we've got maybe a solution to a future problem.
And one thing that I wanted to touch on, based on what you mentioned, in terms of the optimism of how we use this future technology, mm-hmm. is that, look, this is all the basis for a whole bunch of different pathways that we could go down. Innovation doesn't happen in isolation. It happens because there's a confluence of factors that enable something else to happen. And we could be totally wrong, but I'd say let's remain optimistic. There are utopias to build and dystopias to avoid. Which way we go down, we'll leave that up to you, dear listeners. What is the future that you want to build? And this is the question we always try and pose. And I think that might be a great way to wrap up this episode.
I agree.
Yeah, as always, thank you once again, Ben. ladies and gentlemen, we will see you in the next episode. Take care.
Thank you very much.